It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. As with so many breaking news stories in the Twitter age, national media outlets first learned of the mass stabbing at Franklin Regional High School, as well as the conditions of some of the victims via social media. One of those victims, who is also being hailed as a hero, is a student named Nate Simeo. He's credited with pulling the fire alarm, an action that ended up saving other students. Nate was taken along with 19 others to the hospital after the attacker was subdued. After he had been treated for wounds to his right forearm, he snapped a selfie and wrote, "I'm okay, chillin' at Children's." The tweet quickly went viral and was picked up by media outlets, even though police had not officially released the victims' names. In the aftermath, some have criticized the injured boy for tweeting the photo in the first place. But what is the media's responsibility in cases like this? I'm joined now in studio by Gordon Mitchell. He's associate professor in the Department of Communication at the University of Pittsburgh. Gordon Mitchell, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Also with us is Brent Malin, associate professor of communication at the University of Pittsburgh as well. Brent Malin, glad to have you here with us on Essential Pittsburgh.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
What did you make of what this young man was doing and the whole tweet that has caused some level of controversy where he says, "I'm chilling at Children's"?
Well, I think in part we have to think about this in context. And actually, I first saw the story, too, of the stabbing on the local news. And when I saw it, I didn't realize it was also going to be on CNN. And I think that Nate, I assume when he sent this tweet, he was doing what he would do typically in most situations is other students of his age. This is what you do. You send tweets of what you're doing all the time. But you don't know in this case that when a situation that you're involved in might be a national story. And so I'm sure at the time that he sent it, he had no idea that people would be scrutinizing it at this level with this level of detail.
Right. His intention, and it's hard to know exactly what's going through somebody's mind, especially at a moment like this. But Gordon, it would appear that his intention was simply to let people know, especially his friends, that I'm okay. I'm hurt, but as you can see by the selfie that he took, that I'm all bandaged up and I'm standing here talking to you now or communicating with you now.
Right. And Paul, and having this segment, it is I think a nice opportunity to have a teachable moment about a tragedy, and it is something. It's great to see the progress that some of the students are making in the hospital, and certainly sympathies go out to everyone still dealing with recovering from this. You know, when Nate, it was an Instagram photo that he posted on Wednesday morning, 10,000 likes by the evening. And there was actually a prayer service at Cornerstone Ministries that evening where there were journalists, and he did not want to talk to the journalists. So this concept that, he was just after publicity seems belied by that fact pattern. There's another student, Michaela Myers, one of the victim's friends. She posted on Twitter earlier in the day, and then later on, as some of her tweets were circulating, said, "Please, no more news reporters. I understand you all want the story, but this is not the time or place. Thank you for all of your well wishes." So what we're seeing here is, on the one hand, I think it is a very convenient tool for students to connect with each other, but the fact that social media actually interfaces with the broader internet in some ways is complicating that sort of closer deliberative function.
You can join the conversation by calling 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email esspgh@wesa.fm. On Twitter @esspgh. Follow the conversation at #EPLive. What do you think of how this situation was handled, particularly by the media, in the wake of the stabbing attack at Franklin Regional High School last week? What is the media's responsibility here? Has it gotten to the point where the media landscape is so competitive that television outlets in particular are in such a rush to get something, anything on the air, that they'll risk doing something that violates long-held standards, such as not putting the names of a minor, the names of minors on the air when police have not even released the victims' names?
Well, I think one of the issues with the social media and in particular with messages that go viral as this one seemed to do, is that the media are often playing catch up in a way in a story that's sort of developing without them, in a media story that's developing without them. Now certainly even before social network stories could happen.
Let me jump in. Catching up with whom? Catching up with the social media?
With the social media. So, okay. so that there's a media story that's happening that people are talking about that if you know you're a journalist and you see if you're following you see that there was a stabbing and so you see the story happening. That I think there is this sense in which, okay, well, you have to get on this story before the story is scooped out from under you, not even by other journalists necessarily, but by social media. And so I think it's a really tough situation in a lot of ways. And it does it's an added pressure it might be tempting to kind of skip the fact checking, right? And certainly there's not a responsibility on the part of people on Twitter or Instagram or Facebook to fact check. They're just regular people. I mean, maybe we would like them to do that, but they're just regular people continuing a message. So I think then if you're a broadcast journalist, you're a news reporter, yeah, then it's sort of like here's a story that's going on without me that I want to kind of get a hold of. And so either you ignore it or you take the time that it might take to kind of figure it out, or in some cases like this, it seems you kind of go with the story. And I think, yeah, that can cause these problems where you might not ask the questions that it would ask before. It feels like people already know the name, right? So mm-hmm. because there they are, so you just continue with the name. And maybe in a sense that's what you do, but as much as social media can make stories big and again make people feel like they need to cover those stories, I mean, the mainstream broadcast journalism they're using public airwaves, and they have a kind of access to people that social media don't necessarily. I mean, I learned about these things on TV, not through in the newspaper, not through Twitter or Instagram.
Right, and so is it sensible for the media to think that they're, even though they clearly do believe that they're competing with Twitter, that they're competing with maybe Facebook, that really it should be about competing with the other major media outlets, other television stations, newspapers, and observe the same rules that existed before, such as you don't use the name of a minor, you confirm the information before you put it out there, which doesn't seem to be happening anymore. Gordon, I mean, who is the gatekeeper here?
Well, one of the things that's taking place as a backdrop, of course, is retrenchment of the professional media industry. So fewer people are employed actually to be gatekeepers, fewer investigative journalists, fewer editorial staff. And so the traditional infrastructure that existed for this robust checking function is eroding as people are turning more to the internet and other informal sources for news. So that's definitely a factor. It's hard actually to have people who apply the norms and are making these tough decisions to corroborate, for example, sources that are coming from social media under, as Brent said, a very intense time pressure to try to keep up with the flow of news.
And so are we looking at a different standard here? Have the rules changed now? And is it acceptable to maybe make a mistake at, you know, in order to be first, to be fast?
Well, I think the other piece of this is also sort of the establishment of this kind of 24-hour news cycle and the online presence of media, of mainstream media as well. So when you have websites, just like people use Twitter, you know, they're trying to go viral, they're trying to get attention. And I don't think that's the case with
Nate Simeo. Nate,
yeah, I don't think that's the case with him. He's just sort of using this as he would normally. But I think in particular, businesses, that's part of it. You want to have a lot of things, and the more things you have out there, the more people come to you. So if there's a story going on and you're a newspaper, even though, you know, you're waiting till the next day to put out your new paper, during the day you're probably going to be updating things on your website as you get things so that you keep drawing people back.
And so I think, even though they're not even necessarily confirmed.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I think
by the
there
usual
is that
sources that you would have in the past.
Yeah, and I think they should confirm them as they can, but I do think this pressure that you want to have continuing stories, and so in that world, having a bad story is not necessarily bad, because people come, they see the story, then you can tell them you were wrong, and they can come back to have the confirmation. So in that sense, it works in sort of how these things are supposed to work. Now, a story could be so wrong that you could really get yourself in trouble. But if it's a little bit wrong, you know, that's actually not such a bad thing for you in terms of how these media are supposed to work for you.
In other words, it's okay to make little mistakes if you're getting something out there, that you're having a presence online that people can go to, and of course it's fluid, so you can change it, you can fix it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's how the journalists are thinking about it. So whether it's okay or not, you know, I guess we could talk about that. So should they be confirming? But I think for them, just in terms of like PR, it's maybe not even just okay, but it's good, and it might even be good to have some little mistakes so that people. So if there's a story about you that says you ran something that was off, and then people go and look at that, as long as it's not so – like I said, it's not so bad that it itself kind of doubles back on you as a PR problem. You know, you're getting – what you want to do is draw people to your website, and that's what you're doing.
And you can fix it in real time. It used to be that a newspaper would have to wait till at least the next day. You know, there'd be that section with all the corrections, all the things that had been – you know, that were misprints – or factually inaccurate the day before. Now, I mean, you could go to a website, see something, tell somebody about it, and go, oh yeah, look at this. And by the time you pull it up again, it's been revised. Somebody got to the thing that was wrong. We are talking about how the media, the mass media in particular, handled the coverage of the stabbing at Franklin Regional High School and what is proper to do on social media. Should a student who tweeted a selfie from the hospital be criticized for doing so? Is that fair to him? 412-246-2002 is the number to call. Again, 412-246-2002 to join our conversation with Gordon Mitchell, associate professor in the Department of Communications at Pitt, along with Brent Malin, who is also an associate professor of communications at the University of Pittsburgh. 412-246-2002, the number to call. And again, you can reach us via email, esspgh@wesa.fm, on Twitter @esspgh. Follow the conversation at #EPLive. Within hours of the knife attack at Franklin Regional High School, there was a lot happening on social media, including the selfie that was posted by the student from the hospital pointing to his injured arm. Is there something that students – when you mentioned, for example, Gordon, that this was a teachable moment, is there something that students can learn from this in terms of – who is seeing this message, even though it may be intended just for your friends, it's not always going just to them.
Sure. Nate Simeo and Michaela Myers, they used Instagram and Twitter, respectively, which are social media tools that are connected to the internet. And so news organizations in the whole world basically can access the content. Facebook has privacy settings that restricts circulation. There are other apps that are actually coming online, partly in response to recent experiences with protest activity. So you remember after the Iranian elections in 2009, the so-called Twitter revolution. Twitter was used by the protesters to organize their events, but then quickly the government actually, because of their access to the internet, used all the content to prosecute many of the protesters. In Venezuela and Ukraine, we're seeing the advent of these encrypted walkie-talkie apps like Zello and Wicker. And there's another app called Silent Circle that enables you to send text messages that disappear, just like Snapchat. So these are tools that are becoming available that could be used by students if, for example, they want to just restrict their communication primarily to friends and have the messages disappear so that you wouldn't see this kind of putting a message in the bottle and then getting drowned by the wave that comes with 10,000 people liking the Instagram photo and news organizations, you know, knocking down the door to try to get an interview later on.
So your best guess is that this young man had no idea, you know, where this might end up, that he was simply trying to reach his friends and wasn't thinking beyond anybody other than his friends and family seeing this.
Yeah, Chillin' at Children's is an informal moniker. His facial expression seemed to confirm that. Yeah, so my general interpretation of the actual artifact would square with what you said. Yeah.
412-246-2002. Let's go to Mark in Mount Lebanon. Mark, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hi, thank you for having me on. I appreciate the opportunity to comment. Just in the part of the conversation just a minute ago, really grabbed my attention. And basically, I'm appalled. My understanding is that it seems to be condoned or okay at this point to put out false or incorrect information through a news story, allowing that you can create it in real or correct it in real time later. And I can think of 1,000 instances when you would not want to put out any information that was false or misleading because it could possibly ruin reputations, it could cause panic, many things like that. And it seems that part of the conversation was, well, it's okay because it's social media and it's correctable in real time. Can you please comment on that?
Yeah, I do. I will. I do want to correct. I think, Mark, that you might be misinterpreting what was discussed here. What was being put out there was the idea that media outlets might be more willing to risk making a mistake in order to get something out there quicker. Nobody is intentionally trying to make mistakes or condoning it or wanting to do that, but that it has become almost an acceptable practice. And Brent, I'll let you speak to this, to run that risk knowing that you can correct a mistake.
It sounds that the comments were referring to allowing it because it's good business. And saying that it's good business to get out first.
All right, well, Brent did say something to that effect. Let's let Brent respond to what you're saying here, Mark.
You know, but Mark, I agree with you completely about the problem with this. But I think that it is true that media outlets make calculated risks in these cases, and hopefully I'm not I don't want to be suggesting that they're doing it on purpose, but it wouldn't surprise me actually that in some cases that might happen, or that they are being loose with these. And I think you're right. It's a big issue, and it's one of the kind of problems that comes with this 24-hour news cycle and this kind of constantly needing to have news. And if we didn't have that, if journalists didn't feel like they need to do that, they would have more time to check these things. And I agree with exactly what I think you're suggesting, that they should take more time to check these things, and that they shouldn't be rewarded if they don't.
Mark, are you suggesting that are you appalled because this might be happening, or are you appalled that Brent is simply bringing it up?
Well, not exactly either of those. It very much sounded in the conversation that a distinction was being made, not that it was an intentional misleading of the public in any kind of social media, but that because it's a business model that allows you to get more business, to be first in presenting information so that more people use your service, that you have to make allowances for this kind of a thing. And that's what the conversation sounded like. So it truthfully scared me that was a road that was being gone down.
It scares me.
It sounds like, I listening a little further, it does sound like both of you understand that, what is basic good common sense journalism is to, prove and put out. But I want to thank you both. I won't hold you up, but very, very good topical conversation as usual. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. And Brent, what you're saying is that it's almost like that saying, I don't know if it was P.T. Barnum or whoever it was, that it doesn't matter what they say about you as long as they're saying something.
All news is good news sort of thing. Yeah. And I think that we're living in a world where that seems more true. And again, that's not to say that it's right, and I think it leads to lots of problems. And even for – not just for the media but for regular people too, that I think there is this sense in which, hey, I'm just going to – I'm going to tweet something about myself, and just as long as people see something about me, that's good. You know, being known is good, and we have so many people that are famous for being famous today. And I think that that creates lots of issues. So, yeah, I'm completely agreeing with Mark about the suggestion and maybe even pushing it a little bit further to say, yeah, this whole issue is something that we need to be concerned about.
Gordon?
Mark, one thing, when you look at the story, is the journalist actually asserting a fact as confirmed, or are they actually quoting social media and putting the caveat on there that says this appeared in social media? We're not necessarily confirming it as fact. That's one distinction. The other one, in terms of the history of journalistic practice, you said you were worried to go down that road. We're way down that road when it comes to journalists quoting unattributed quotations from government officials. So that is a major problem that our mainstream media, especially in the Beltway, have been dealing with for decades, is this deal where they trade access for the willingness to actually quote government officials who are anonymous, oftentimes uncorroborated and oftentimes slanted or spun in the direction of representing the administration. So there's a long history of this kind of wrestling with how to deal with borderline sources.
Let's go to Joel in Cranberry. Joel, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Yes, I wanted to make a point about the language of the news media. In these recent incidents, the media always makes a point, we don't have a motive established yet. Well, when somebody robs a bank, I guess the motive is to get money. But when somebody engages in this kind of violence, there's no real motive in a rational sense. They're mentally unbalanced. So I wish the media would quit using that word motive with respect to these violent incidents. I wonder what your guest had to say about that.
Gordon, you want to respond to that.
It made me think of Pastor Dan Hertzler, who's Cornerstone Ministries in Murraysville, and he's been organizing some of the prayer services out there. There was another case, actually, in this community, a student suicide back in October. And after the suicide occurred, they discovered that there was a trove of unknown online journal entries that the student had left. And so this is causing Dan Hertzler and others in Murraysville to try to work with a developer to launch an app that is a kind of 90s-style suicide hotline that uses social media to enable teens to interact via anonymous text and instant messaging with counselors. So the question of motive in some ways is relevant to social media and this community trying to strive to actually learn more about what is motivating students to commit violent acts or suicide.
Joel, thank you for that call. Let's go to Matt in Mount Lebanon. Matt, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Are you there?
Yes, we are. Hi.
All right. Hi. I just want to remark that what you are saying is typical, what I will call journalism speak. You are describing a situation with regard to journalists that never was, is not now, and never will be. From the days of yellow journalism back in the before the beginning of the last century, right up until the present moment, reporters are working on the basis of it. If it bleeds, it leads. With regard to fact-checking, and I'm sure I will be dismissed as a radical rightist, I spend a lot of time reading the New York Times, and I find it replete with errors, things that I go back and check on the Internet to the basic documents. So I am tired of hearing that somehow or other, unlike the Pope of the Catholic Church, that only pretends to speak ex cathedra, that is, this is the absolute truth, with regard to a handful of things, you endow journalists with this, what is the word I want, ability to know and to act in the most accurate moral way.
Well, I mean, isn't that what all journalists should and in many cases do strive
to
do?
No, a lot of journalists do not do that. They should do that. But you only have to look, for example, at the New York Times, some would say Fox News Channel, and you will see that they do not do that. With regard to this poor kid that you are assailing, with regard to the selfie,
thank you for the call, Matt. I appreciate it. We are not assailing the young man. We are simply pointing out that some people have, and whether that criticism can be in some way constructive going forward. As far as the point some of what Matt was saying. Brent Malin, what would be your response?
Well, I agree with him. It's I think maybe I was saying some of the same thing in response to Mark's question as well. So yeah, I think he's right that there is not a moment of golden, completely objective journalism, and we can go back to 19th century, 18th century. I mean, we could go through time. The partisan presses. I mean, there was a moment when the newspapers were explicitly political, and then talking about the journalism in the United States around the end of the 19th century, early 20th century, they adopted this model of objectivity, which was largely commercial. That they were trying to sell more papers. Newspapers got more expensive. They were trying to sell more papers to papers to more people, greater audiences. So yeah, I think it's true that all of these models are business models largely. And so I agree with the point that we have not had this golden moment of objectivity, but still perhaps, you know, moments of fact checking and these kind of things can change, and how important that seems within the model can change too.
Gordon, you wanted to chime in.
Yeah, Matt sounds like he's leaning right. He wanted us to call him a radical rightist, or I think he was anticipating that. But he also reads the New York Times, so I tip my hat to him and want to quote a New York Times journalist, Michiko Kakutani, who says, "Cognitive dissonance has become a national epidemic in the United States." And that has to do with not enough people like Matt who are reading across their political interests, actually engaging in publications that aren't necessarily consonant with their own political views. Social media in some ways exacerbates that because it's all organized around this filtering and sorting mechanisms that enables you to just talk with people who are like-minded, who share your preferences. And some social psychology research says that's dangerous, that you can actually have a shift to extreme opinions when you have people actually reinforcing their opinions and just talking to like-minded others. So, Matt, the best part about your call that I liked was the fact that you said you're taking the time to read material that doesn't necessarily come from your own settled kind of media ecosphere.
We're talking with Pitt professors Gordon Mitchell and Brent Malin. An email from Emmanuel: I find that I am tuning out social media more and more because too much of the information is not reliable. And this would go back to the whole idea of the gatekeeper. There doesn't seem to be one in this case, and that might be why Emmanuel is saying what he's saying.
Yeah, and I think that the kind of flood of information, although in the early 20th century, people complained about the flood of information and too much information, and journalist and social thinker Walter Lippmann said that – he said that basically exactly, and he talked about what he called the disenchanted man, which was someone who was so overwhelmed by information that they couldn't pay attention. And so that was in the 1920s. And so I guess there's a question of what's going on now. Are we doubly disenchanted, or are we sort of identifying again the same thing that Lippmann saw then?
One last comment. I think this was on Twitter. The day after the stabbing, one of the local television news stations had a promo up and running about their coverage of the event and how they were the news team you could count on. Isn't this in somewhat bad taste, using this event for their own promotion? Gordon.
The news team that you can count on. Yeah. What specifically were they claiming, though, about, you know, the role of social media in the reporting?
No. This was simply a television outlet that was proud of its coverage and saying that because of the way we covered this event, we're the team you can count on. And the feeling of the emailer was, or Twitter, the person tweeting this, was that they were exploiting. What I got from it was that they were exploiting the situation. But that's been true of any number of media outlets over the years, hasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, tragedies are news, and the community needs information about them. So I wouldn't necessarily fault the media organization for covering it. You know, Emmanuel saying he's tuning out of social media, distrusting it, that could be evidence of kind of a pendulum swing. You remember the advent of blogs and social media causing people to question, hey, why do I need to pay to actually buy a newspaper? Can't I just get all my news on blogs now that they're so ubiquitous? Emmanuel sensing, well, maybe not so much. I mean, there is perhaps something to supporting news organizations who can apply professional norms, hire investigative journalists to fact check and provide corroborated information that can be trusted more. Maybe we'll see more citizens actually, you know, purchasing newspapers, investing in Knight Foundation type organizations, that kind of thing.
Gordon Mitchell and Brent Malin, associate professors in the Department of Communications at the University of Pittsburgh. Thank you both for being with us.
Thank you.
Coming up, discover how the locally developed app, a locally developed app, can help students graduate on time. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.